Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Ewlings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Ewlings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists, to turn working artists into thriving artists. I'm Daniel DeGree, your host. Despite having 200% more education, working artists earn $6,000 less than workers with similar education. More than 35% are self-employed, yet less than one-third have achieved full sustainability, meaning they fully support themselves with their art. The difference between just making art and creating a sustainable art career that strengthens an economy for a lifetime is proper business training and tools. You can have an exponential impact with just a small donation. So give small at clarkewlingsfund.org/impact. Your investment does not buy an artist a fish, it buys the fishing rod. That's clarkewlingsfund.org/impact. We'd certainly appreciate your small gift. Now, our guest today is Peter Trippi. Peter is editor-in-chief of Fine Art Connoisseur, a bi-monthly magazine for collectors of representational painting, sculpture, drawings, and prints. He's also president of Projects in 19th Century Art, Inc., the firm he established in 2006 to pursue a range of research, writing, and curating opportunities, such as the recent traveling exhibition, Lawrence Alma Tadema at Home in Antiquity. Peter, welcome to the show. Can you take a minute to tell us a little bit more in your own words about yourself and what you do?
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. This is really a thrill. I am an art historian, but I'm also an arts administrator. I have a rather peculiar background in terms of my training. I have master's degrees in both art museum administration and the history of art. And so I'm glad to say that that has proven to be useful in the sense that it allows me to juggle various balls in the art world. As an independent person, I come out of a museum background. For many, many years, I worked in museums as a fundraiser and as a director, but now I'm doing these various projects, as the name of my business suggests, and I love it because I get to travel widely and meet lots of interesting people, and the magazine Fine Art Connoisseur is the bedrock of my existence. I love the chance to examine different topics in art and share those discoveries with our readers. So it's a real thrill to be based in New York and always on the go and meeting interesting people who are artists or scholars.
Now, Peter, you've curated the traveling exhibition Lawrence Alma Tadema at Home in Antiquity. Can you tell us a little bit more about why you got involved with this show?
Absolutely. This show is something that came about organically. I'm glad to say that it's about people keeping in touch with people they like. Essentially, I had organized an exhibition of J.W. Waterhouse, the Victorian painter, 19th century Briton, Pre-Raphaelite, or at least a late version of the Pre-Raphaelite, and that show went over very well. It opened in the Netherlands in 2008, and it toured to London and Montreal. And that went so well that I kept in touch with various people in the Netherlands, and indeed the city of Leeuwarden, which is just about half an hour's train ride away from Groningen, where the Waterhouse show had opened, they got in touch with me and said, hey, we loved what you did with Waterhouse. Would you consider doing that with Alma Tadema, who was a friend of Waterhouse? And it all made sense because I knew a fair amount about Alma Tadema too. And my answer was simply, yes, absolutely, glad to help, but as long as I can co-curate the show with my colleague, Professor Liz Prettjohn, who's at the University of York in England. And they said, yes, absolutely. And so we took it forward. This project actually cooked pretty quickly. Normally, it takes 5 to 6 years for a huge project like this to make its way into museums. But we had a deadline. There had been a grant made to the museum in Holland, and they said, we really would like to spend it soon. Let's do it. So we scrambled, and we got it done. And it opened in October of 2016, probably less than 3 years from the first conversation. So, you know, if you told anyone that at the Metropolitan Museum, they would probably fall out of their chair because it usually takes 3 years just to get the paperwork done. But we decided that we would fast track it, and we succeeded. So I'm glad to say that worked out well. It was a risk, and it was a risk worth taking.
Well, it sounds like it. And this, you know, the Waterhouse exhibition, it was the Netherlands, but also England and Canada. And you, in 2002, actually published a detailed study of J.W. Waterhouse, which sort of reassesses the painter and his work in some way. I can't say that I know a lot about Waterhouse other than The Lady of Shalott. So maybe you could comment on that.
Sure. That project was exciting and very long by comparison. I began researching J.W. Waterhouse in 1997 when I was commissioned by Fyden Press in London to write the book. they were looking for a larger a survey of his career, one larger than they already had in print. And I said, yeah, I'd love to do that because I've always thought he's really interesting. And indeed, it took me 5 years to get that book done because I was working at the Brooklyn Museum all the way through in another role, not as a researcher, but as head of fundraising. So that was juggling, but I loved it and I did it. And that book is still in print, I'm glad to say, from 2002, because this is such a great artist, not because I'm such a great writer. That book led organically to the exhibition I mentioned earlier with the Groninger Museum in the Netherlands. They got very interested in him, and I said, sure, let's work together. So it all felt very comfortable. Waterhouse was a great painter, very poetic, a kind of late romantic, very much associated with the Pre-Raphaelites in terms of his subject matter, very melancholy, sometimes very passionate, almost erotic. But he dealt with these images in a slightly different way than people like Rossetti or Burne-Jones. He was a bit more academic in his technique. For example, his drawing was absolutely impeccable. And he had generally larger compositions, not quite so intimate. But that was fun because people really respond to Waterhouse. Even today, you'll find websites all over the world devoted to his art. There's a real passion for him because his subjects are so emotionally compelling. And Lady of Shalott, of course, is a fine example. It's one of the world's most famous paintings. And it was just brilliant to have that picture in all three of our venues as the show toured.
Well, of course, you know, some people get into classical music by listening to Looney Tunes. I was one of those. And maybe Schroeder on Peanuts. I got interested in, you know, Waterhouse's painting because of a song, The Lady of Shalott, which was done by Loretta McKennitt, and who I'm sure someone along the line, along the way said, you look a lot like the Lady of Shalott, because she does. And so for our listeners who are familiar with that Canadian musician, it's a wonderful lay or ballad or whatever you would call it, and, you know, crossing over into Arthurian themes. So I want to go back to Alma Tadema now, because it's a curious phenomenon. Alma Tadema was known for storytelling and became famous in his lifetime and then sort of fell into obscurity after his death in 1912. And to curate this show, I guess my question is, what is it like to essentially have to resurrect an artist like that from obscurity in order to have an exhibition?
Well, we were very lucky, in fact, because the resurrection is only partial. Let me be clear. Interestingly, Alma Tadema has been doing just fine on the commercial market. His pictures, the major ones, now sell in the millions of dollars at Sotheby's and Christie's and Bonhams. So, in fact, there is respect for him, and that has been the case since the 1970s on an ever-growing basis. In 2010, a picture sold for $29 million, and then in 2011 for $35 million. It might have them backwards, but it doesn't matter. You get the point that there's a kind of blue chip aspect to his finest works. I feel that that is only part of the story, though. Museums have not done a very good job of addressing him. A lot of museums around the United States, Canada, Western Europe own his pictures, but they don't really know what to do with them. There was a show 20 years ago in London and Liverpool, co-curated by my colleague, Professor Prechon, and that was successful. But that's 20 years ago. That's a whole generation or more ago. And there really hasn't been a proper show since then. And we thought, let's go ahead and bring him out again with additional pictures that have surfaced in the meantime. And let's also tackle him from a new vantage. Let's not just say, hey, here's a great artist, birth to death, telling the story of his fascination with classical antiquity. Let's think about it through the lens of his homes. And I know that sounds a little weird, but in fact, in London, Lawrence Alma Tadema created two fantastic studio houses, one, then another. He and his family lived in these houses, and they were amazing. They were beautifully decorated and very much visited and photographed. And those houses were basically laboratories for the family to make their own art. And we can prove that in the paintings. We can show portions of the house that appear in the backgrounds of the paintings. But more importantly, it's about techniques of looking. And I can be more specific about that if you want. But this was something fun for us. We decided to tackle him in a new way. And the paintings that we selected reflected that different vantage. Also, I should add that we were adding in the works of art by Laura and Anna, the wife and the daughter. And that's not been done before. In the previous approaches, it's always been Lawrence only. And we said, no, this was a man who really loved his wife and children and wanted them to be part of his artistry.
So you and I have talked before, Peter, in other venues than this show, about Clark Hewlings, the painter, and obviously for whom the Clark Hewlings Fund is named. And, you know, one of the topics that we discussed was sort of he's the darling of collectors and certainly well known among people that are excited about this type of art. But, you know, there hasn't been enough done in museums and with exhibitions to kind of get the art opinion makers to sort of acknowledge that. And do you feel that that's the same thing with, that we have the same situation with Alma Tadema? And I guess I want to ask you, if it's similar or if it's close, why does this happen?
It's a great question. And I think we need to look at that connection between past and present very carefully. These things continue. I think that part of it is the likability factor of some art is worrisome to some intellectuals. And I'm not trying to sound anti-intellectual, but I'm trying to say that the popularity of Clark Hewlings art among collectors and among people who are just looking in a very easygoing, uninformed, very pleasurable way is something that makes some scholars, some curators anxious. They feel like it's just too accessible to be good. And Alma Tadema certainly was criticized that way over many decades. People felt that they were well-crafted pictures, but they were too likable, too charming, a little bit what they used to call chocolate box, to be desirable for serious museum display or exhibition. And therefore, they were kept in storage and not really talked about. And that, I think, is annoying because it really denies the public a chance to see things that they enjoy. Now, balancing that is a little tricky, let's be honest. And I'm going to use a name that you know, and maybe I'll get in trouble for using it, but Thomas Kincaid was a painter of very pleasing images of countryside life. And those are often accused of being repetitive and sentimental and inane and not especially well made. That's a matter of opinion, of course, but millions of people across the country have his pictures or his reproductions. And, you know, I think that we have to recognize that there's a kind of line where you need to track the balance between popularity and quality. And that is something always under negotiation. It's not easy to legislate. It would be terrible if anybody legislated that. That's not what we want in a free society. So I would never want to accuse people of actively, well, delegitimizing Alma Tadema. That certainly was not the case. But there was a kind of intuitive reluctance to go there. And now what we're seeing is a slow turning away from that. And in particular, if you allow me to go on, I think it's about the fact that we're past modernism and postmodernism into an era of anything goes. That because of the internet, in part, we have younger people coming up through the world who have no preconceptions or baggage about what is, quote, good or bad. Now, that's good and bad in its own way. You know, that lack of discernment obviously is a concern. That's why we call our magazine Fine Art Connoisseur, because we want to help people discern. On the other hand, that freedom is liberating, and it means that people can vote with their own feet. And I think with Alma Tadema clocking in at 150,000 people this season in a small Dutch city, the Fries Museum in Leeuwarden, where he was brought up as a boy, something's going on. There's something very palpable here about people looking with their eyes and talking to each other enthusiastically about art that may not be officially acceptable to the elite curators. So this is really good stuff. And I think Clark Hewlings absolutely points to this same issue, the situation with his art being received by museums or not.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring that up. You know, we can't be afraid to reference people like Thomas Kincaid. I think that, you know, in the interest of diffusing snobbery, I'm not a huge Disney fan. I'm annoyed at what it's done with certain concepts in the world, but I'll be in the shower singing tunes from Fantasia. And, you know, you can't deny the catchiness of those tunes and some of those themes, you know. So I think there's a place for all of it, but I think what you're kind of underscoring is that, you know, there's the freedom is important, but there's a tension between freedom and depth, or freedom and sophistication, freedom and tradition. And if you just abandon all tradition, you get in music, you get tiddlywink music. In painting, you get things you can't identify as paintings. In fact, I recently saw something called the Museum of Invisible Art, where you know raise a lot of funds and bring your concept, and that's all it'll ever be.
That's all it is.
That's all it is. It will be a concept, you know. And it's like, okay, wow.
And some people are fine with that.
Yes, hang a tag on the wall under where you plan to explain your concept, and then leave. The tag will remain. And then explaining what the name, what name you gave it. So there's every shade in between. And I love the part about people answering with their feet. I was in Florence recently and saw a Klimt exhibition. The only disappointment I had is there weren't any Klimts in it. It was all theater projection, and they don't really tell you that before you go inside.
But,
there were no paintings in the Klimt exhibition, which was disappointing indeed. But it's funny. There is a resurgence of interest in visual art, almost as a rebellion, I think, against much of what's happening in the digital world, much of the leveling. People are looking for something a little more transcendent, especially perhaps at times like these. So I'm glad that you're passionate about doing these retrospectives and bringing some of this stuff back up again. I wonder if you can give us some insight about what contemporary artists, working artists, can do if they don't want a similar fate to befall them. Not that the fate is terrible. Clark Hewlings is a well-known painter. He's, you know, Alma Tadema obviously is a well-known painter, and many aspire to be forgotten from the heights of being well-known. But what about if the artist wants a legacy where you don't really risk falling into obscurity, but you also don't risk falling into an absolute populism of art, to use another buzzword from January. What's your advice for working artists?
I think it's a great question. We have to think together about this. Obviously, all of the issues of legacy are in flux enormously right now. And part of that has to do with this huge generational shift. As the baby boomers come into legacy planning, there is this frenzy of anxiety about how that's going to all be rolled out. How do the works of art get preserved as people grow ill and pass away? And how does the next generation take care of them and celebrate them and so on? People who are working today in their prime need to be thinking one step ahead as well, because there's this tidal wave occurring now with that generation of baby boomers. It's something that bothers me, frankly, because the art world, as interconnected as it may seem, is not really dealing with these issues in a very coherent, across-the-field sort of way. And that's one of the reasons I really like what the Clark Hewlings Fund is doing, that there's an element of clarity, of business-mindedness, of neutrality. It's not about style. It's about the vision and the practices of good legacy building. That's appealing. And I think Alma Tadema would have appreciated that himself if he had been around to see it. As you said, in fact, his reputation collapsed pretty quickly after 1912. That was in part due to many historical factors like World War I and the rise of modernism and so on, which we really can't get into here perhaps. But coming back to our own time, I don't know that we're going to have such a cataclysm again. I'm hoping that we're not going to have any kind of World War III that would knock everybody off the rails and change taste completely. I think that it's more about everything sort of rolling along on relatively equal footing. The opportunity for living artists, to answer your question directly, is to get out there and tell their own stories through the internet and social media. I actually think that's very important, that an artist like Tadema, who was so sociable and engaged in friendships and community and on every possible board and committee, would have absolutely loved filmmaking and social media and YouTube, because he would have been able to get those points across pretty compellingly, and those would stick around longer than he did. This idea of becoming savvy at telling your story, at what is it about you that is so individual and so special that other people should take note? How does the work differ from things that might look like it? That can be communicated pretty compellingly and briefly in a 3-minute YouTube video or post of some sort. And I think that's a great advantage to us, because the traditional media outlets, including my own, by the way, are getting fewer and fewer. and slimmer and slimmer by and large. I'm glad to say our magazine is pretty healthy right now, but you know, when you look at the New York Times, it's pretty skinny compared to what it was 20 years ago. And that certainly would pertain to the arts coverage and size as much as to the classified section, which is basically gone. So we have to recognize that these ways of reaching each other are in constant flux. I think living artists should be very optimistic that there's still a healthy appetite for art to be bought and consumed and looked at. It's just occurring in different ways. That the traditional gallery model, a retail storefront, that's really dying, slowly but surely, because people are not going out into the streets to buy things like they used to. You can see that through clothing shops, clothing, for example. So why would art galleries be any different?
Well, it's interesting, you know, the sort of elephant in the room backdrop to what you're saying is a little bit of the apocalyptic doom many artists are expressing. And I'm not saying my feelings, I'm saying they're expressing it in publications and on the web and blogs, etc. Since the start of the new year, you almost feel like the flying monkeys are coming out of Oz. And but the question I guess I have is, you know, if arts organizations like the Clark Healings Fund, you know, I'm dedicated to this mission. For me, the most important thing I can do is look at the gap in the economy, the hidden economic potential of working artists to contribute not only financially to our economy and our society, and not only to beautify it, but to be self-sustaining entrepreneurs, to even employ others. This is an amazing area where the gap has not yet caught up with the decline in jobs through automation, etc., jobs that are never coming back. And everybody is calling for the return of factory jobs and jobs that automation will never allow to come back. And not enough people, in my view, are calling, at the risk of expressing an opinion, are calling for the need to give artists the support that it takes for them to take their rightful place in the economy, which isn't new. If you look at the booming economy of Florence, you know, at the time of that the Duomo was built, you just have this an amazing explosion of artists driving that economy. They're the backbone of it. And now it's almost like, you're considered lucky to starve. So I agree with you that CHF fills a pivotal role by providing entrepreneurial education to artists. And then Fine Art Connoisseur, you sort of got the other end of the seesaw. You're saying that we need to help people make discerning choices about art. It's great to have the freedom, but in an atmosphere where everything goes, absolute freedom means all things are equal, and you can't tell the difference between having art in your life and not having art in your life. Then, you know, something you buy at IKEA might as well take the place of a Klimt or an Alma Tadema. So I love that part is being filled. And then you personally, there's a third leg of this stool, if you will, you know, by doing things like what you're doing, this retrospective, whether it's Waterhouse or Alma Tadema. You know, I could sort of tease you and say, what are you being the necromancer of the art world? You know, you're resurrecting the obscure. But it's a critical role to get us to look again at things that we have forgotten, that we risk forgetting probably in every era. So my question to you with that sort of as setup is, where are the remaining gaps? What else needs to happen that isn't really being handled? From arts organizations and nonprofits and publications and individual art aficionados like yourself? Where are we leaving the door open and letting it leak away?
That's terrific. What a great summary of our status. Absolutely helpful. Really, really helpful. I think going at it from the macro, just for a minute, you're quite right that what we really need is some sort of national dialogue led by a few really informed voices about how we can build the creative industries of our country to be more visible, more numerous, more robust. I love the idea there that the individual people are small business owners themselves, and they are creative. Their work cannot be replicated by a machine, and it is absolutely profitable if it's managed right, and it benefits everyone, including the tax authorities and other people in the community by, you know, filling space and people buying coffee and decorating their homes and all of that. My sense is that Britain has done a fairly good job in the last 15 years promoting the creative industries through the British Council, which is a nonprofit group somewhat allied with the government, trying to spread the word around the world that Britain is open for business on those fronts, whether it's design of objects or filmmaking or graphic work, advertising. All of those things are encouraged by the beating of the drum and the showing off of the quality. I don't know where that stands right now under Prime Minister Theresa May, but I have a feeling it hasn't changed a whole lot. We've never really had that in the U.S., and I think that's dumb. I think that the Arts Endowment or some comparable entity in Washington, God help us, could make that point very cogently, because America is already well regarded around the world for its creativity. But I don't know that that whole sector has been really pushed into, first of all, a kind of respectful mode. The whole idea of the crazy artist living in the garret, you know, making art because he has to, is just so ridiculous. It's not helpful to anybody. And also, if we were to measure really carefully the sheer value today and the potential tomorrow of this sector, I think everyone, including the White House, would be blown away by what is there. And it's just not happening. So that's the macro look. Coming to my own little world, first of all, with the magazine, absolutely, we want to encourage collectors to collect more discerningly. And so we just put only good things in front of them. I'm glad to say that I select every picture in the editorial section, and I'm proud of it. I don't have any IKEA art, and I don't have any Thomas Kinkade. Now, I also don't put lots of great art that is already super famous, whether that's Monet or Van Gogh, or whether that is someone who is working today who is already getting lots of credits in the New York Times and Art News and so on. I sort of feel that our role is to go one notch down on the fame chart, not on the quality chart, and put in front of our readers those names, whether they're historical or contemporary, because that's more of a service. We're telling stories, highlighting individuals who are not so familiar, because we don't need to replicate what the mainstream media is doing already. So that's fun. And then with my exhibitions, to answer your other point, I think that this idea of putting great things on view in a museum where people come and experience the works of art directly, that's great. The paper and ink are wonderful, but there's nothing like being with the picture right there in the room. And that pleasure that you get, the insights, the ability to study things, you get the reflections, you get the textures, all of that has to be in person. And I'm glad to say, as you all know, museums are booming in this country and abroad. They're really busy, because people are eager to get together in a safe, relatively neutral space to look at things together. You know, whether they complain about the crowds around them or not, they actually are happy to be with other people in a controlled environment. And when I say controlled, unlike the subway where, you know, any nut job can pick your pocket any day, in a museum it's more likely to be regulated in some way. You can go have a coffee and use the bathroom without worry and so on. That is, I think, a really great opportunity for all of us in the arts to zoom in, to say, okay, the internet, social media, over there, informing people in their pajamas, learning about things around the world, middle of the night, but then let's get them into the museums too, during the day, and let's have them look at real works of art and communicate with each other about them. And I think museums are rising to the occasion beautifully. The only problem is, speaking frankly, a lot of them have overbuilt, and they are now absolute slaves to the cash register. They must program popular exhibitions which are can't fails, and that makes for rather boring programming overall. They're brand name artists, mostly, whether they're historical or contemporary, and therefore Alma Tadema, please notice, is not on view in a U.S. museum this year because we just didn't bother. We felt that American museum directors are so fearful of failure, of a name that is not familiar, that we thought, you know what, we'll just put it on in Europe because we recognize those museums are going to recognize the appeal more readily. We were in a hurry. We didn't have time to go into great depth and tell the story of Alma Tadema to people unfamiliar. And I'm not complaining. I really am not, but it's just what it is. I will point out one thing, by the way, Dan, that there is a show coming this summer about Alma Tadema to the Clark Art Institute in Williamstown, Massachusetts. It's a very small focus show about a design of a music room that he did for a 19th century New York millionaire. That's fascinating, but it is not the whole story. It's really a project show, but we're thrilled about it, and we're going to highlight that show as much as we can, operating across the ocean from us.
This is really fascinating. I love going off script. You know, my bullet list of things to ask you about says we pivot now to explore your role as editor-in-chief, but I don't wanna. I want to pick your brain about something else. So you touched on the struggle with museums needing to generate the big buck, you know, the big obvious sort of presentation to get maximum boots through the door. And I can see the costs affecting them because when I go, large sections of the museums are often shut off for no reason other than they don't have a person to stand there and make sure you don't put the painting in your lunchbox. I notice there's a pattern among the parts of the museum they choose to prioritize versus rope off and say, sorry, not today, we're short-staffed. And the pattern has to do with a perceived obscurity versus fame of the artist. But very often, I don't want to see the same Monet that was here last month. I want to see, I really want to explore this group of students of a particular artist and what they did and how they deviated from the course and sort of and created a school, albeit, you know, originally launched by somebody we know. And I can't do it. Very often, a museum is not so much a place for me to explore as it is a place for me to sort of get permission for what I can look at. And so that's not meant to be so much of a complaint as to be a preface to ask you about a trend that I understand is happening, especially here in New York City, arguably bastion of the big city art world. No offense, Chicagoans. But I read an article in the New York Times that said, and I saw this again just recently in another article that said New Yorkers in the know do this. The New York Times article said that there's a phenomenon happening where much of what we used to go to museums for, we're now turning to the art galleries of Chelsea, and we'd rather spend an evening touring those with a couple of glasses of wine than paying our buck to get into the museum and do it that way. And it explained that there's a business force driving this too, and that's that many of the galleries can no longer afford the rent or they're getting crowded out, you know, this constellation of artsy areas, officially artsy areas of the city. The district of galleries and the districts of museums. And what they're doing is they're moving uptown, they're moving to other neighborhoods that where they're in there with restaurants and cafes and they have fewer, so there's less of a culture. And so their solution to this is to create shows where you have sort of an exploratory experience and you actually buy tickets to these shows and go through them much the same way you would a museum. And that for many people, this is replacing the sort of museum experience. And so my question to you is this a fad? Is this something that we can expect more of, this sort of maybe democratization? Do you see this happening at all? And what do you make of it?
Very interesting. I have not come across this so often, but I have no reason to doubt the New York Times or you that this is a trend. And it doesn't surprise me too much in the sense that we see that some of the Uber galleries, the ones that are very wealthy, are able to mount really spectacular shows that are museum quality in every way, that trade upon their strong connections to collectors and even to museums. Whether they're selling the works of art or not off the walls is almost immaterial because they're building their brand. For the smaller galleries that are going in this direction and are more hungry, if you will, I think they're on the right track because that's what I would do. They see that museums are successful gathering places and they want that too. They don't want to be ignored. They don't want only people looking online at the JPEGs on their sites and saying, well, not interested, well, go there. That's not good for a business person. You want people to come in through the door and get charmed. So I feel that mixing of models is absolutely part of our time. That, for example, just to get nitty-gritty for a minute, the movement of people from the museum world into the staffs of dealers or auction houses is now very common. Back and forth, back and forth. There was a day when I was starting my career in the late 80s where that was a no-no. Once you crossed the line, you could never go back, especially if you went from nonprofit to for-profit. Those days are over. So that corresponds with what you just said. And I think that that's okay because, after all, the skills are enormous. The people working in these operations are very talented. And why should their views be somehow, if you will, encircled, limited to one sector or another, as long as they're behaving ethically? That's the most important part. Regarding the customer, hey, they're free. They can go anywhere they want. And if they're going to pay a ticket price at a gallery, and get a great experience out of it, good for them. If they feel that they're only being sold to and that this is a trick, like, frankly, like that weird exhibition you described in Florida, then they're going to remember that and they won't go back. So they'll figure it out. You know, they'll vote with their feet. And that's okay. We need to recognize that that customer has his or her own opinions and sensibilities and sense of fair play. That's all right. The art market can take it. What I don't like is this, well, deception. And again, coming back to the Florida project, that doesn't seem very fair. We have to make sure that everyone is very transparent about what it is they're trying to do.
Yeah, well, and just to clarify, it was Florence, Italy, but, you know, it's a traveling exhibition.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought
no,
you said
well, I
Florida.
Think it's probably been in Florida. It's a traveling exhibition. It goes around the world. And in fairness, somewhere in there, there could have been one Klimt or two that were hanging that I missed, but that wasn't the point. It was a lot of cardboard cutouts. There was virtual reality headsets. There would be like four headsets in a line of 40 people, and you would take turns trying these on and sort of moving your head around to look at, you know, digital images of Klimt, JPEGs, as you mentioned. And then you'd go in and listen to music as projectors, coordinated projectors, displayed parts of Klimts and various Klimts onto the architecture of the room. And while it was fun for a few minutes, I just personally would like to have known that there were no actual paintings used in this production.
Right.
So, you know, that would have been nice. Just like going to the Museum of Invisible Art, it would be nice to know that you will not, in fact, see art. That invisible means invisible. At least they're advertising it accurately.
Absolutely. I must say, that's true.
That's fair. That's more fair. So I'm now suspicious of this word experience versus something else. But, you know, to pivot from the museum conversation, you actually pivoted from museums. You know, you worked at numerous museums, and then you chose to make the shift to a magazine. So what caused you to do that? What made you want to choose that path?
Well, I must admit that the opportunity came out of the blue. I was certainly not hunting for a magazine job. I thought that I would just go right on into another museum from the Dyess Museum, where I was director. That museum closed. It will reopen at some point in the near future, thank goodness, 10 years later. So the collection is safe and sound, and the trustees are behaving so honorably in collecting all through that past decade. It's thrilling to see they've been buying good works of 19th century art for the future home of the museum. I think that I got to know the publisher of Fine Art Connoisseur, Eric Rhodes, at an event, and I thought, oh, good guy. This seems like an interesting opportunity because this is a way of conveying my passion for quality in a new format. And I had always been very paper-minded. I've always, all my life, been a writer, an editor, you know, working on the Student Association newsletter in college, on the high school newspaper as editor. So this was not foreign to me. And of course, museum people constantly are churning out proposals and catalogs and all of that. So I knew how to do it. And I can't believe it's been 10 years going on 11 since I joined the magazine. That's the longest job I've ever had. But I felt that this was right because it was very much going to be advocating for quality in the kind of art areas that I support personally. I knew that I wouldn't have to be covering Jeff Koons, for example. We don't need to get into a conversation about Koons, but he's got all the attention he needs, and I didn't have to go down that road in this role. And that's a very special privilege that I appreciate every day. The notion of being a cheerleader, an advocate for the artists that I admire and the kinds of art that I admire, that is something that is from the heart, that you are, of course, using all the press releases to come in and talking to people at events and so on, but you also have to have a bit of a vision to say, well, which ones? And I am very much a curator on paper. I am thinking about how this is all going to look together, and also what is the message of the article. We don't just do features on individual artists. We also do themes, and we do a series of hidden collection articles where we look at individual collectors' homes and talk about why they have these pictures and how they came to be so enthusiastic. We're trying to get people interested in the passions of other people. I think that's the most normal, ancient tradition of all, that we all are curious about each other and we want to know what makes other people tick, and maybe we could do that too. So that's been a real joy. And I'm learning all the time. I have to say, it never ends. I could do this for 50 years more, and I would still be discovering, learning new things, and also exploring our country. What a wonderful country we live in. I mean, I've been now to almost every state in the Union as part of my job, looking at events like painting festivals and museum exhibition openings and symposia. And I realized that every single state has got something really good. I'm not a New York snob. I think that the whole idea of art capital of America doesn't really hold up anymore, given the interconnections of travel and internet and touring exhibitions. You know, I think New York is a very special place, but it really doesn't have quite the hold on the art conversation that it did even 20 years ago.
This is fascinating. I'm curious, though, when you are looking, when you're curating a show or deciding what goes on the cover of Fine Art Connoisseur, you know, you've already kind of narrowed down what your criteria are for featuring, for having things in the magazine. But how do you get it down to the point of what goes on the cover or to a single artist? Is there some pivotal point that grabs you and says this and not the other thing?
Sure. I must say the cover is almost the easiest part in the sense that we're always looking for a very strong graphic. It won't surprise you that a lot of our sales come from newsstands, Barnes & Noble in particular. And so we need something that is striking and that is easily legible. If it's a very detailed picture with lots of little figures, that's not going to work. It needs to be relatively bold. And obviously any illustrator, including Clark Ewlings, by the way, could have told you that it needs to communicate very quickly across a distance. So there's that. But yes, of course, I'm thinking about all the different articles that are going to be in this issue and saying, okay, which ones are more likely to have those strong graphic images, and we'll go with that. We often try to prioritize a theme of our photo spread. We will gather, let's say, 30 photographs of new artworks by artists on a specific theme, like the body or the horse, and we'll put those into a 10-page spread. Those are often perfect for the cover because they are so intrinsic. You know, I mean, the horse, I mean, how can you lose? We have a fantastic horse image coming on the cover of the March 1st issue. But, you know, more than that, I think that we want to mix it up and try to keep our readers a bit surprised. We've got destination articles where we're saying you should go visit this city because it's got rich museums and galleries and other nonprofit spaces that you can visit as a cultural tourist. The hidden collections that I mentioned before, some thematic explorations like conservation of art and what's happening in that sector right now. I think we're trying to address the fact that most of our readers are curious, and the reason they're getting this magazine is because they don't really look at art as an investment asset, more as a pleasure, as something that is a journey and a life's pursuit. And that I love. I'm not interested in investments because if I were, I would have gone to work on Wall Street long ago. That's where investments are best managed. The art investment class thing that's going on right now in our society is deeply uninteresting to me and will certainly end in tears at some point. It always does. If you look at the history of art, there have been these bubbles and they always collapse. It's not any one party who makes that collapse occur. It's the times, World War I being a brilliant example. I mean, nothing was the same after World War I, and many, many people lost their shirts on the art that they had invested in before, and nothing could make that change. So, you know, I'm not wishing for that, believe me, but things like that do happen, and we just have to be frank about it. The notion of a magazine as a champion for these ideas is very exciting, but also fragile. We have to recognize that distributing paper magazines is getting harder and harder. We all know it because of the technology around us. And we have a digital edition for the magazine. We also have a weekly e-newsletter, and we put some content up online. So we're trying to be as 21st century as we can be without going all the way away from paper, because paper gives a certain kind of pleasure.
Well, I certainly encourage our readers, our listeners, to become readers of Fine Art Connoisseur and to peruse your website. There's a fascinating lot of articles and presentations there, including, you know, one recently called The Cowboy Way, I think you explored Terry Rowland's art, which is interesting, really sort of off offbeat or off the beaten track, at least, and I don't even know what category to put that in. So that in and of itself is fun and challenging. Definitely not, as you say, not a snobbish magazine. But I'm curious, some of the practical aspects that may interest our working artists about the magazine might include, do you have any tips for artists about submitting their work? Do you take submissions, and you know, how do you vet those, and what sort of tips do you have if you're a working artist and one of your goals is, hey, one of my goals, I want to be covered in Fine Art Connoisseur. How do you make that happen?
Sure, absolutely. We're very open. Basically, we love to get emails. It's as simple as that. These days, most things come through email rather than in the mail itself, and that's fine. I'm the one to send it to. And my email address is posted all over the website. And I think that I sift. That's my job. I've always been a sifter. I look through all this huge flow and say, okay, this looks promising. And I get back in touch and say, let's keep talking. You know, send me more information. Or I think we might hold you till the fall because there's a whole theme taking place in the November issue, et cetera. Sometimes I don't have time to reply, and I just have to kind of let it sit in the inbox for a few months until I can get to it because it doesn't have an urgency. Sometimes it's just not right, and I'll tell someone right away that this is not a good fit because it's too abstract or whatever. I love that learning that I do every time I open up the computer because that is a gift. The truth is that we don't have guidelines set out on the website because we like to keep it a bit more fluid. I mean, really, a press release is fine. An email of inquiry is fine. Maybe a web link, fine. All of that is very quick and easy. We never want to put someone through needless paces. You know, create a proposal. That's time spent. And we would rather have that artist working at the easel than making up documents for us. So the joy these days is that most artists seem to have websites and can send the link. And that will tell me a lot of what I need to know, whether it's the images or the bio or whatever. And we just take it all on a rolling basis, basically. The only thing we announce in advance are the destination themes for the next year. I'm talking about cities in America that we cover. Also, the three to watch section. Those are emerging artists. We choose three for every issue, and that means 18 per year. And those are selected a full year ahead because we want everyone to be able to plan. But for 2018, I have nothing planned. So I'm really ready to hear from people who are wanting to tell their story. For feature articles on individual artists, I usually select myself. I don't normally accept, if you will, proposals. I mean, they're going to be fairly major figures, and I am keeping my eye on them. I'm talking about a 4 or 6 page article. That's a feature, as opposed to a 1 page, 3 to watch article. So I'm getting a little nitty gritty here. That may be more than you wanted, but I just think, you know, we're very receptive. The key we have to stress is that it's representational. Some call it realist. That word is controversial in its own way, but, you know, the point is that you can actually tell what's going on in the picture or sculpture. I often receive emails from people with abstractions, and I think, well, obviously they weren't reading anything on the website very closely because there's nothing abstract there. That does not mean that we hate abstraction or conceptualism or minimalism. There's quality in every category, right? But we just don't do that because we can't cover the entire waterfront in 6 issues per year. It just wouldn't make any sense. So I hope that helps.
I think it does. I think our many of our working artists readers are listening eagerly to what you're describing and how easy it is. You know, it seems like such a low threshold. I hear people sort of pining away of, you know, one day when I achieve the level that Fine Art Connoisseur talks about me. And the response to that is really, well, why not talk to them? There's an opening there. The editor said, email me. So, you know, it's nice to hear that it's that open. That's about as non-snobby as one can get. And yet, you know, you have uncovered a core piece of advice that we should kind of have as a learning instance when you're submitting to any publication, and whether, you know, one is an author submitting a story to a literary publication, or submitting art or any other kind of story, a news item to another kind of publication, you got to read the magazine a little bit. You don't have to buy the year subscription if things are tight, but pick up a copy or two and see what they're doing. It's sort of like, you know, if you want to be a guest on the show, listen to one or two of our podcasts, and we're about as open as it gets, but know what we're doing. And the cool thing about Fine Art Connoisseur, I'm actually really surprised and want to ask you about this, is that you can get a subscription on your Kindle. There's an electronic subscription option. It costs the same as the print subscription, and I'm comfortable with that too. I have a lot of digital subscriptions, and I prefer them. And with an art magazine especially, you know, you have to have really high quality images. It takes something to produce, you know, it's not just about saving ink. It takes something to produce the digital version of this and have it be a satisfying experience. And so my question to this about this is, you know, the online art auctions are thriving, and artists, visual artists, are using social media to reach a wider audience. And we, of course, are providing, Clark Healings Fund is providing digital education and career and entrepreneurial education to working artists through the digital realm. How is technology changing for you the art industry, but more important, the act of art curation? And how is Fine Art Connoisseur really tackling this as new digital formats emerge?
Well, that's a big one. Wow. It's a good one. You know, the fact is that I love the internet because it makes all of those images and names so much more accessible. I think back, how would someone have done my job 40 years ago? I don't even know how you would actually get the information and see the images so efficiently. I feel so blessed that we've got this at our fingertips. Obviously, they made it work 40 years ago, and that's great. But I think that maybe the range of references must have been smaller. It must have been much more clubby or much more dependent on paper mail, where, you know, some people got it through and others just simply didn't because they didn't have the address. So here we are in a totally new age, which is getting faster and more overwhelming all the time. But it's good. You know, it's actually fundamentally a good thing. The idea of collecting and sifting, therefore, becomes easier in the sense that I can get the whole story relatively quickly. On the other hand, there's just sheer volume. That's why I admitted that some of the stuff just sits in my box for a while because I have to get to it. It sort of works its way down. The avalanche of information and images available to our society, and especially the younger people now, is something that we've got to work on. I think that there becomes, at a certain point, we see the setting in of a kind of numbness. It isn't just about relativity. You were talking about that earlier, that I think you and I would agree that not all things are equal, that some are better made than others. But even more than that, that we sometimes begin to shut down, and we only go for the one that appears the most times, and, i.e. there's more advertising money behind it. That's not good. We have to recognize that there has to be some other sifter for us. And that's one role that I play. I'm basically distilling an avalanche of information into 140 pages that you can look at on paper or on your Kindle. And I hope you'll trust me to kind of have made selections for you. And there's always next month where we'll have a different group of artists and works of art to savor. So that's a joy for me. I like that. I've always been a sifter. For the rest of us, you know, out in the world, I don't know where this is going to go. I think no one really is sure. I mean, we hear all the wisdoms about, well, don't worry, the 25-year-olds will eventually turn to paper. They'll start reading the newspaper because they're going to lose their eyesight and they'll get bored with gadgets and tiny little screens and all of that. Nobody knows. Really, nobody knows, because the technology will also have changed by that time, right? It's only going to get better or different. So I think we all have to just hold on tight and keep believing in what we're doing. The format shouldn't be so very important. It's the content. And that artist offers the individual voice, the authenticity, the uniqueness that no one else has. And, you know, you may be borrowing bits and pieces from your teachers and your role models and Soroya and Sargent and all of that. But actually, at the end of the day, you are you. And that, I think, is a very great gift. And if we can just keep that in front, and not worry about, well, how does it stack up on the auction market pricing charts? You know, that's really not so interesting to me. And I can promise you, as an art historian, that those ways of looking at art always fail in the long run. To be very specific, the art stars of the 1980s in the East Village of New York, most of their hot selling art collected then is now in museum storerooms waiting to be deaccessioned quietly. That fashionability thing usually ends in tears. Today, we're seeing this massive kind of pantheon being erected by, you know, the big museums and Larry Kukosian and so on. But you know what? Even those are very vulnerable to the passage of time. And we just need to hold on and be true to ourselves and not cave or change to become like so-and-so over there because he's making a lot of money. That's not actually very helpful. I think that we've got it better than that. I think that we can find those ways of connecting our story with a wider public. Maybe not the broad public, like, you know, 50 million people on TV. That's asking for a bit much. But, you know, an audience that actually can buy the works or admire them and talk about them, that's a little more manageable.
So before we pivot to the third and final segment of the show, not to sound the tone of doom, but we have to let you go at some point. Regrettably, I would like to keep you on for several more hours. There's one other question I want to ask you about this sort of role of editor-in-chief and your perspective from that. You see everything, and maybe this is an unanswerable question, but I'm going to try it on you anyway. You see everything from the start of an artist's career to potentially their end. You just described the bitter end for some of the sort of more trendy, hip art efforts that don't pan out. You see sometimes the whole trajectory. Are there some generalizations that you can make about why some artists in the end are successful and some simply never are?
Well, yes, I think I can. Not that I will ever finish my thoughts on this subject. I think on my dying day, I'll be like, "Well, what about this?" But here's a thought. Here's an attempt. In general, it's this weird convergence of factors, some of them fully controllable and some of them outside your control. And I think that we have to take comfort in that. To be specific, what the Clark Ewlings Fund is doing is teaching artists, showing artists how to manage their rollout better. That's great. And that should be a baseline, because the art is what the artist wants to do and make and be. That I don't want to get in the middle of. I mean, that's really up to the artist. But the execution of the message making, of the marketing, of the engagement with the next circle out and the circle beyond that, that can be managed by the artist more proactively and more efficiently without becoming a professional marketer and losing sight of the art itself. So there's that. But also, let's face it, that there are all these other players in the world who are going to be watching, ignoring, skeptical, enthusiastic, dying off, being replaced by people who care or don't care. That's not in your control, that you just have to keep doing what you're doing. I think that in particular, an important set of gatekeepers are museum curators, because they are the ones who basically grab the work from the studio and put it on view in front of a larger public. And their role is perceived as being neutral. They're not making money off of it. They're not dealers. Well, yeah, okay, but I just finished saying earlier in our conversation that a lot of curators were dissing Alma Tadema because they felt that he was just too popular, that, well, wait a minute, you know, this is kind of pitch, or it's not really very challenging. They said the same thing about Andrew Wyeth, by the way. And now look at Wyeth. You can't touch him. I mean, not just commercially. You can't even get a loan for your museum show of an Andrew Wyeth because he is so reputable now. I'm glad he lived long enough to see that happen, and obviously it's become even more so since he passed. My point being that that set is tremendously important to keep in mind. Now, trying to convince curators that your art is good, that's hard, because they are often putting up big defenses, and they're bombarded, and they're under deadlines, and they're underfunded, and so on. Dealers are a little easier in the sense that they have every reason to respond to your inquiry if they feel that there's a commercial prospect here. I mean, if they're still in business, bless them. And they'll say, yeah, you're going to sell. Let's talk. And the key, of course, is to resist their pressures to make more pictures with horses or pictures with red. You know, that you have to make sure that you're doing the art you want to do. Beyond that, forget the world of critics. It seems to me that newspapers and magazines are slowly but steadily cutting away proper criticism from their offerings because they just can't afford it, or they say they can't afford it. The bloggers out there who write beautifully about art are often hard to find, that you have to know where to find that blog to read it. And that's one of the great challenges of the internet, that you can Google all day long, but you know, it's going to sort in a very peculiar and idiosyncratic way, and you may not find the best writer on your favorite topic. Beyond that, then, thinking about the worldview that you described of, you know, how do we gird for this change, it seems to me that trying to connect with other people in the same orbit and to try and tell a unified story. I especially love to hear from, for example, groups of artists who are mounting an exhibition on a theme or on a style or a particular inspiration like a country. That's great because it shows me that they're thinking laterally, that they're collegial, that they're not just about me, that they're actually interested in some ideas. And then I'm happy to promote that a little more aggressively through our announcement service or possibly through a page in an exhibition preview section. Those are more interesting because they connect with my readers' interests. And again, I want to underscore the idea of theme as something that is very compelling as opposed to some person's name. Obviously, every certain month, I'll get some shocking article about a really cool technique that has never been done before or is being done in a totally new way. And I'll say, oh, yeah, that we have to cover because it's so intriguing. But most people, let's face it, work in fairly conventional materials. And it's not going to be that window through which we enter their world. I'll finish by saying that the notion of courage, that it actually takes a lot of courage to just be true to yourself and to keep doing that work. You have to be flexible and mind what others are doing and telling you about, sorry, that doesn't look good, try this. I mean, fair enough. You can't be absolutely resistant to changes and tweaks. But at the same time, to not get sucked into the desire to be popular, that's probably the hardest thing because our times are so conforming. I say that we're told that teenagers now are being shaped by social media and engagements from people they don't even know. And that's really a worry that we have to make sure that doesn't happen to art too.
Well, that is a thorough and fascinating tour and yet leaves me salivating for more. So we're going to stick around for one more segment of the show. But meanwhile, I just want to address the audience for a moment and say, if you're finding value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 per month lets you sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. A portion of our funding goes also to deliver direct education to artists who've demonstrated a clear, achievable plan for transforming their businesses into self-sustaining and thriving ones that fill the world with art. So share this commitment with us now at clarkhulingsfund.org/impact. That's clarkhulingsfund.org/impact. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, Peter, fine art connoisseur, as we've discussed, focuses primarily on realist and representational art. But what stylistic and what genre trends are you seeing in the art world on a larger scale? Are we going into a post-realist era, a neo-realist rediscovery? Is there no way back from absolute subjectivity that we kind of talked about with this sort of post-Jackson Pollock anything goes? What is our place in history at this moment, do you think?
It's confusing. I must say that I really feel that everything is up and running at the same time, which is great, but also bewildering, perhaps, to collectors, to observers, to commentators, critics, and artists themselves, I'm sure, that really representational art, or let's call it realism, is thriving. There's a lot of great stuff being made at a high standard. There are lots of people emerging from the ateliers and academies with really great skills in drawing and figuration and landscape painting. I mean, they really know what they're doing. Sculpting, absolutely superb. So that is not in decline. If anything, it's actually growing. My chief concern is whether there is enough of an audience or a market to keep those folks going, or will they lose interest and need to pay the rent and go off and do something else, whatever that might be. I should point out that there are transferable skills in terms of illustration, in terms of animation, video gaming, all of that. I'm not saying anything new. It's always been thus. But now, of course, that world of Disney that you referenced before is hungry for well-trained artists. And certainly the atelier crowd is welcome at Disney or Lucasfilm or any of those other places. I feel that the clutter, the sheer variety of things that are okay is making it somewhat difficult to find the audience or to find each other. sometimes. Obviously, the internet allows you to sort and choose and so on, and that helps a bit. But when you go out into the galleries in New York, for example, you're going to see absolutely everything, all in the same 10-block radius. You know, in Chelsea, you're going to find incredibly carefully painted realism, and you're also going to find toilet paper installations billowing in the breeze provided by a fan. All of that is considered viable, and you're welcome to buy it. We just need your credit card, please. So there's no judgment being made by the market in that regard. When it comes to museums, I'd say that, you know, by and large, overall, there's an inclination toward conceptualism, just generally, that is very much where it's at, with the occasional realist chucked in. Someone like Alex Katz, who's been doing his kind of flattened realism for decades and still is brilliant at it. Someone like Walton Ford, who is riffing on John James Audubon and making spectacular, huge watercolors, very intricate with lettering and words. You know, those are absolutely successful representational artists making millions of dollars every year. So one should not be without hope if one is a realist. But I feel that this cacophony is good and bad, that no one is excluded, but no one is absolutely front and center except commercially. It's money that has made you a star now, not reverence from the elite of the critical core, you know, such as it once was. Obviously, everyone likes to beat up on Clement Greenberg, but let's face it, you know, he made and broke artists every day as a critic. Those days are over. Nobody's listening. And that's just our times.
Well, so you're singing the same song that the people are who talk about what we've lost going from rap to hip hop or from certain kinds of literature to others. You're describing, if not to put words in your mouth, but if I could sum up, almost the wilderness of everything all at once. And the worry that you've expressed is that the wilderness of everything all at once might leave any one thing unsustainable, or might mean that the things that do break out simply because of funding and aren't that sustainable for very long. So it's really a fascinating thing to watch because, you know, we sort of came into this from talking about digital a few minutes ago. And the, you know, you talked about the fact that you have this emergence of everything all at once precisely because digital puts it all in front of us all at once. That we don't have these really long historical cycles where one school gets either radically rebelled against or flows into another, but instead we get all history gets flattened and leveled, and everything sort of is with us together. But that, I think, it seems like that would make it even more important to distinguish between artistic styles. Like, you know, in throughout the show, even in the first segment of the show, Peter, you were kind of referring to representational art with a nod toward, you know, a lot of people say realism and that's debatable. But I have to mentally keep these things separate. For me, I'm not particularly a fan of realism at all. Not photographic realism, not the attempt to get every brushstroke to be a pure mimicry of nature. But I really only like, with a few exceptions, representational art. So for me, I don't think that's artificial. I don't think you think that's artificial. I think it's there's when you have everything emerge all at once, as we're talking about, don't we run the risk of conflating these concepts and simply equating things that aren't really the same?
Absolutely. Yes, it's tricky. And I don't envy us, I suppose. I mean, if I were on Mars looking down and saying, oh, well, here's the whole history of humanity, and boy, this is a really weird time these people are in right now. you know, it could be a lot worse. We could all be starving. So I'm not in any way complaining, but it ain't easy.
Well, give it a ways to go, Peter. It's only January, end of January.
You're right.
Give it a few more months.
You're right. I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're absolutely right. I will hold my tongue. It seems to me that this makes it tricky. And so we have to be mindful of that and get on with it. And try to connect with the people who are going to be getting it the most. You know, I've never been a believer that absolutely everybody in the world is ever going to love art. I mean, that if we can grow the audience incrementally, we should be feeling very lucky. I do, however, believe that we should absolutely try. you know, that things like the National Endowment for the Arts are the right thing to do, because you never know who's going to get hooked. I mean, it could be absolutely anybody who not only becomes a great talent, as we've seen many, many times, but also becomes a consumer, and their lives become richer and happier for it. So we have to carry on in that direction. It's not only for the insiders and the elite and the wealthy. That's not right. They are valid too. All those people deserve to see, but we need to make it bigger and better than that. I wish our magazine could be absolutely free to everybody, available all the time, but that's just not a good business model, obviously. So we have to kind of control where it goes. But more cosmically, if I may, I think that we've got to recognize this tension between these different forms, that they're not competing in the old-fashioned way, because people don't really want to be perceived as movement-oriented anymore. I'd say that it's about when you walk into a room and see an artwork or an artist's work that it's just great. It kind of doesn't matter whether it's your kind of realism or made of fabric and totally abstracted. It's great. And we don't have to cover that fabric abstraction thing, because that's not what we do at our magazine, but it's not that we're against it. We recognize that those artists are worthy of celebration too. It's another magazine covering them, and that's fine. So I feel like that's something that has to never be lost sight of, that I don't want to get too tribal in a way, because that ends up being closed-minded. And that's really not one of the purposes of art and artistry and connoisseurship, for that matter. It's got to be an equal playing field to an extent.
Well, we've been milking the brush of your ideas for more than an hour now. I promise I have only three more questions, unless, of course, I think of another one. But I'm gonna ask you first, kind of a slight pivot or variation of what we've been talking about. You have, of course, this really strong background in 19th century art, really strong background in British art. I'm sort of curious about why this interests you so much, given the focus of the magazine, which is quite current in many ways. And so, you know, another way to put the question is, why are you so focused on historical works of art? Why not focus just on the here and now?
Absolutely. Well, I'm a bit of a contrarian. I must say that, you know, one of my formative experiences was going as a kid around the Smithsonian Institution. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and my mother was very active in the Smithsonian as an employee. And so I had the privilege of going around behind the scenes to the various museums with her, or sometimes without her. And one of those great encounters in 1976-77 was the Arts and Industries Building, which still stands on the National Mall next to the Air and Space Museum. And it's basically a giant Victorian pile. And at that point, it was filled with a recreation of the Philadelphia 1876 World's Fair. And it was all Victorian, right? It was all 19th century, much of it British. And I just thought this was super cool. And I think that sunk in. And although I went on to do other things in school, I kept coming back to that. And ultimately, I got hooked on it when I studied in Scotland and rediscovered that heritage of British 19th century. I think I am drawn to that period because it is essentially the mix of romantic, sexy, and modern. It's a very interesting conflation that the Victorians, and in particular I'm looking at the British, because they were a bit more willing to put it out there than the Americans were. They're English cousins, right? I mean, Henry James and all of that. But the British, although certainly very buttoned up compared to the French at the same time, you know, it was all about sex in France, but not so much in England. It was a little more under the surface. And that, when you look at the Pre-Raphaelites, and I'll zoom in on them for a minute here, because that's what got me hooked in the first place, that there is this kind of 18-year-old boy having a fantasy thing. Dante Gabriel Rossetti was 18 years old, and he's like thinking about girls, and he's making these red-haired beauties, and J.W. Waterhouse inherits that fascination with the Lady of Shalott, and so on. There's that aspect of it. But there's also an intelligence applied to the eroticism, that there is this awareness of literature, of history, of religion, of philosophy, and then the modern, that actually, if you look at the Lady of Shalott closely by Waterhouse, you see that, no doubt about it, this painter was using photographs. He absolutely was making that face, that body, from photographs, even if he had a live model, that he's aware of modernity. And that was new, that no previous generation had been able to make that mix occur because photography was new, 1840. So that is cool because essentially the Victorians were the first bus. They were the ones who got steam trains going, and they could travel pretty much on the same schedule as we do today. To go from New York to Washington today, about the same time on a train that it was 125 years ago. They didn't think so much about that journey, nor do we. Now, the jet set thing, going off to Singapore for the weekend, that's 20th century, and forget about it. I'm not even interested in that. But I feel that there is this aspect of the 19th century forming much of who we are today. And, of course, as it gets farther and farther away, it becomes a little more distant to younger people. I mean, I'm born in 1965, so, you know, it's not that far away in my brain. But the reason I then try to connect that to the present, to answer your question, is that I feel that that recent past can be very helpful to us today. That to study the Middle Ages is not very useful for me because I think they were dealing with such a different world, such awful challenges about, well, everything. I mean, life was, as they say, nasty, brutal, and short, that it's not even pertinent. But in the 19th century, setting aside some things like infant mortality and, you know, cholera, there were a lot of things that were very similar to what we've got now. And I think that that then can be borrowed from and learned from, that history is, if it's used properly, a mirror that allows us to see ourselves more frankly and to take the best of it, to learn from its mistakes, and the art is also inevitably part of that. Why anybody teaches a history class without art on the screen behind, don't even ask me. I can't even imagine looking back why anybody would have tried that. Now with PowerPoint and free access to images, every history teacher should use imagery to tell the story because it's absolutely gripping. Once you see an image of Louis XIV in all his grandeur or Catherine the Great, you never forget them. You got to see the picture. You can't just hear their name. You have to understand who they looked to be. You know, they were presenting themselves, and ditto for the Victorians. They were very much cognizant of what the appearance would tell other people. That's good stuff.
Well, I am moved by that advocacy. You know, as an educator myself, I serve as educational director of the fund and designer of our educational program. And so consequently, much of the, at least the overall content, not every bit of the design, originates in my thinking. And I'm not a particularly visually inclined person. I don't have the skills that a graphic designer or a visual artist have. I envy them. I can look, but I'm the guy that can watch a movie. I can't make one. And so as I hear what you're saying, I can feel a gap that I would like to try to fill better, and certainly a gap in the education that I received at the hands of many schools. The thing that I've noticed, Peter, that keeps people from doing what you say, even when the opportunity is there, is actually the same skepticism that makes history so undesirable as a topic to so many people, which is, you know, we can't really tell what's real. There's such a belief in absolute subjectivity that we can't tell the difference between a fairy tale and a historical event. We don't know what's made up. We question everything. So when you look at a painting of somebody like the Sun King, you question whether or not the artist was being paid to interpret away the wrinkles and interpret in the majesty, and that it isn't, in fact, a photograph. And so there is this at the same time you have an artistic rebellion, arguably, against representational art and against realism in particular. You have almost an outcry for realism as the art that supports our understanding of historical periods. So it is indeed a confusing time, and I would love to see more of what you're talking about. It brings me to another question, which I figured out how I'm going to ask you. It's the most loaded question of the day, and so I'll end with this and anything we want to talk about off of this. So I've spent the show loading it. And it is, the short version of the question is, Peter, why is art political? And I realize that you could give an entire year-long lecture and do a graduate degree on this question and still not be finished with the dialogue. But the reason I ask, you know the reason I ask, it's because of what we're seeing unfold around us in the United States. And regardless of where one falls on the spectrum of attitude politically, art has become one of the battlefields in which we are having the discussion. And the reason I know this is because of the art blogs and the art magazines that are talking about this. They're using phrases like the war on art. They're using phrases that suggest a defensiveness and also perhaps a real need to defend. And it disturbs me because at the same time, there's this phenomenon where for you and I to look at a magazine like Fine Art Connoisseur and to talk about art, there is a contingent of the United States that would look at us as snooty to do that and assume that we think we're smarter than other people. You know, I remember being in school and if you liked anything other than Black Sabbath and Van Halen, you risked a punch in the nose because, well, you think you're smarter than I am, you nerd, right? And the truth is that art has got to be more accessible than that. It's got to be for everybody. It's got to be, in a certain sense, democratized. And yet we're polarized along these lines where they're not. So that brings me back around to, as context, to re-ask the question. Why is art political, and why is it political in the way that we have made it in January 2017?
No, absolutely. That's profound. I'll say, to get very specific for a minute, that at Fine Art Connoisseur, I'm going to keep it totally apolitical. That you know, whatever other publications are saying, you know, that I'm planning the March-April issue, which is the first issue that is being produced after, well, really after the election and after the inauguration. So it's just like all the other ones. I feel that we've got to keep it focused on the art and not on society overall. But I do absolutely appreciate your interconnecting of the two. I think there are other forums where I can contribute on that subject, like this one, for example, that we're having now. I feel that, number one, coming back to the political thing in history, of course, you're absolutely right. Louis XIV didn't look like that, but that's the way he wanted to be presented. And that is, in a way, the more important point. If photography had been around in the 17th century, he would have looked quite different, to be sure. But this aspect of teaching history, of saying, here's who he wanted to be, and what other people thought of him, because that's all they had to go on. They never saw the man himself. They only saw the portrait. That is what really matters in the end, in terms of our understanding of how history unfolded in his lifetime and after. Coming back to the present, then, if indeed all imagery is subjective and loaded and chosen by the artist or the viewer or the dictator or whatever, it is what it is. And that is not a new story. And the popes and the Medicis and the cavemen in France can tell us all about it if we interview them in a time machine. That's not going to change. When it comes to advocacy and activism today, obviously it's a free country still, and people can say what they will. I myself am a little edgy about mixing the art up with those dialogues because I'm not sure that they actually translate. I'm not worried about losing business or customers or, you know, artists losing their friends on Facebook because they've said something political one way or the other. I think it's more about, is that really pertinent? Is that actually where the good can be done in the making of points, in the making of arguments with your fellow citizens? And certainly, you're right, the recent past has revealed a huge schism in our society about, well, ideas and images and knowledge and expertise and the intellect and all of that. It's really up for grabs right now. And I don't know who exactly is going to corral the conversation so that it's meaningful and not just epithet, name calling, you know. That doesn't get us anywhere. It never did in history, and it never will again. I feel that the business about the National Endowment for the Arts, by the way, is something separate, in my view, in that arts are defined very broadly there. So that, for example, I was reading an article that there is something like a $350,000 grant being spent now on film archives in Appalachia and Kentucky. This is material that wouldn't normally in the New York art world be considered artistic at all, but it absolutely has cultural value. So in that regard, one needs to look very closely at all of the grants that the NEA awards, and ditto for the Humanities Endowment, before making any judgments about the more difficult or edgy productions and performances and exhibitions that have been funded with federal grants, or state grants for that matter. All of this is tied up together, though, to be sure. I think you're absolutely right that we have to be mindful and also very careful in our wording and not let it devolve into something that damages the art, the artists themselves, so that they become fearful or somehow resistant to other people. If anything, I would argue that by putting something in the middle of the room and everybody gathering to look at it, whether that's physical or virtual, we have an opportunity to talk about it, to see that other people see that thing differently than we do. That's okay. We just have to understand why they feel that way, what makes them think it's too dark or too bright or too red or whatever it might be. Let's go there. Let's have that conversation. And art can kind of take the emotion out of the room. I mean, if it's something that is a thing and it is not actively telling a message, like it's not emblazoned with a slogan, for example, I mean, you're just asking for trouble if you look at that kind of artwork. If you're looking at something that is decorative or ancient, Renaissance, 19th century American, whatever, that is more neutral and allows us to recognize other people in the room as different and still valuable. And of course, that's empathy. That's hugely what's missing right now in our society. And what I love about a work of art is that that was made by some other person whom I did not know or don't know if they're still alive. And yet I can gather something meaningful out of that. And whether that's the intention of the maker or not isn't really the point. I mean, if it is the intention, good for me, aren't I clever? But it doesn't really matter. It's about that thing having its own life. And I want to share that joy, that I feel empowered having that skill. That's all I've got, is the skill to look and describe and unpack. And that is so freeing. And if we can share that with other people in a very non-preachy way, good for us. Let's do that, because that gives them power and self-esteem, a bit of control, especially in this era of tidal wave imagery. They can actually resist and not be snowed. They don't have to be drowning. They can say, no, not that imagery, this imagery. That is pretty powerful stuff. I would argue that a lot of forces in our society don't want people to have that power. They would rather let it snow, just wash them away, let them buy what we want them to buy, let them vote the way we want to vote. All of that is packed together, and we have to be very frank about that. It's pretty toxic if you stop and think about it, but we can do our part by helping people resist, by controlling their own eyes and minds and being able to speak about what it is that is in front of them.
Well, I'm glad I asked the question. You know, when I said, of course, when you said that fine art connoisseur needs to remain neutral, because I can't imagine it doing anything else than what it's doing. And when I look at it, I think it would be a mistake to take the bait of participating in a distraction. So, I mean, sure, we could all go out in the streets and create art with messages across the top, very much like what you might get at a religious bookstore. You know, there's a sunset with a slogan, but the art is the statement, and it doesn't have to become a statement or have a statement added. It's already the undistilled statement, just the act of making art. It's not a statement just in rebellion, not a statement just of contribution, not a statement just of how we find the way and sustain ourselves, but it's all of the above. So I like the fact that fine art connoisseur, without being overtly political, is inherently political by continuing to maintain the course and avoid that distraction. Maybe I've misinterpreted it, but for me, that's the value of you holding the line.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. That's exactly what I meant. And I'm proud of that. And I think our publisher would agree, and our staff and our readers would agree, that that's probably the right road to go. And, you know, it seems to me we're all entitled to our own views, you know, off the record. But I feel that I'm so grateful for having stumbled upon art early in life. And I thank my parents for that in particular, that it is so freeing to have that as a guiding premise that notion of whatever it is, whether it's an object made to be art or some image or thing that is completely not artistic, but nonetheless capable of being unpacked, that you've got that skill, that ability, that predisposition to analyze it, to unpack it and say, what exactly is happening here? That is so powerful. But also, stepping aside from that, the understanding of history, which comes along with an appreciation of art, that you eventually, if you look at enough art, you say, well, when was this made? And, oh, that's a long time ago. Gosh, what was that person living like? You know, was it a primitive existence, or was it very sophisticated, or which country? And you begin to travel in your mind, if not in your body. That also is empowering, because I think, you know, this is a scary time, but there have been many scary times before in history. And if you know enough history, you say, oh, okay, let's put this in perspective, shall we? You know, this is different from the 1930s, which is different from the pogroms, which is different from the revolution, which is different from the Civil War. But they all had their awfulness, but we're going to distinguish and learn from those experiences. That is so empowering. And even when it comes to mortality, you know, I am not going to be the first person to die when I approach death. Lucky me, living till old age, perhaps. It's going to be the first time for me, but it is not the first time in human history that someone has died. And so just even being cognizant of how earlier people have died is so empowering, because you then have more control over how it's going to be. I don't mean literally choosing where you're going to drop, but I just mean that struggling with mortality is one of the most basic features of human life. And even art can help in that by, well, obviously tombs and mortuary decoration and all sorts of reliquaries, things like that are addressing that very human theme. So it's endlessly rich. If you get the chance to crack into it, it just never stops.
You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. For more information on Fine Art Connoisseur and Peter Trippi, visit fineartconnoisseur.com. For more information on the Clark Hulings Fund, visit clarkhulingsfund.org. To sponsor an artist with your small but impactful gift, visit clarkhulingsfund.org/impact. And be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Peter. It's been really great having you.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much, Dan.